First reading is a poem by Dorian Lowe, whom Steve Abbott introduced me to this week. He will read the piece called The Life of Trees. It was written in 2007.
The pines rub their great noise into the spangled dark, scratch their itchy boughs against the house. That moan's mystery translates roughly into drudgery of ownership. Time to drag the ladder from the shed, climb onto the roof with a saw between my teeth, cut those suckers down. What's reality if not a long, exhaustive cringe from the blade, the teeth? I want to sleep and dream the life of trees, beings from the muted world who care nothing for money, politics, power, will, or right, who want little from the night but a few dead stars going dim, a white owl lifting from their limbs, who want only to sink their roots into the wet ground and terrify the worms or shake their bleary heads like fashion models or old hippies. If trees could speak, they wouldn't, only hum some low green note, roll their pine cones down the empty streets and blame it with a shrug on the cold wind. During the day, they sleep inside their furry bark, clouds shredding like ancient lace above their crowns. Sun, rain, snow, wind, they fear nothing but the hurricane and fire, that whipped bully who rises up and becomes his own dead father. In the storms, the young ones bend and bend, and the old know they may not make it, go down with the power lines sparking, broken at the trunk. They fling their branches, forked sacrifice to the beaten earth. They do not pray. If they make a sound, it's eaten by the wind. And though the stars return, they do not offer thanks, only ooze a sticky sap from their roundish concentric wounds, clap the water from their needles, straighten their spines, and breathe again.
The second reading is from the Tanakh, the Hebrew scripture. It's from the scroll of Yob, or Job. It was both written and compiled by anonymous authors between the 4th and 6th centuries before the beginning of our era. The Hebrew in Job is the most difficult Hebrew in the entire Tanakh, and it's one of the rare poems from ancient times, the rare pieces of literature from ancient times, that is both sarcastically humorous and richly philosophical at the same time.
Why do you confuse the issue? Why do you talk without knowing what you're talking about? Pull yourself together, Job. Get up on your feet. Stand tall. I have some questions for you, and I want some straight answers. Where were you when the foundations of the earth were being set down? You know so much. Tell me what you know. What influences contributed to the earth's size? Do you think there were blueprints, measuring tools? Do you have the original plumb line? Did you help pour the stone? Maybe it was you personally who set the cornerstone while all the morning stars brimming the sky were singing for joy. Did anyone you know take charge of the first waters when they gushed like a newborn from the womb? Did you build a playpen for the waters saying, "Stay here, this is your place. Your wild tantrums are confined to this seabed"?
Thank you.
This last summer, I went to see a film by Terrence Malick. I went with high expectations because of my haunting and very vivid memory of seeing his film Days of Heaven more than 30 years ago. The cinematography of that film was so over-the-top beautiful that I remember people gasping out loud in the theater. The story in the film Days of Heaven was not the point. The story was simply a retelling of the rather sordid biblical tale about Abraham making a small fortune off the king of Egypt by loaning his wife to him. But the film's sheer beauty overcame even the tawdriness of that tale. Many people who went to see the movie Tree of Life this summer, however, were not grabbed by the beauty of the film. And it was indeed beautiful. They just walked out of it. Many more, who stayed to the end because of Malick's reputation, walked out during the credits, shaking their heads and saying aloud, "Really? Really?" I admit it, the film was long. And although the beauty of the cinematography was sumptuous, the story in the film was more moving than the one in Days of Heaven. The story portrays a Waco, Texas family in the 1950s. Father, mother, three boys. One of the boys dies, although all you see is the grief and not the who or the how. That's odd enough, I suppose. But the film also shows, and I'm not making this up if you haven't seen the film, everything that ever was, beginning with the fabled Big Bang that exploded into what we now call the universe. Malick shows us the formation of the stars and solar systems out of the Hubble-revealed clouds of dust, the whole development of the Earth through ages of lava and steam, the evolution of life, one-celled creatures, fishes and ferns and trilobites and dinosaurs. They were hadrosaurs, I think, if I'm correct. And even a surreal image of a beautiful end to everything far away in the future. In other words, Malick sets a limited particular moment in time, a family in Waco, Texas in the 50s, with singular people living singular moments, right in the middle of the unlimited, impossibly majestic flow of creation from beginning to end. Like a small jewel, perhaps, on 10 acres of black velvet. The film reminds us that we are but very small leaves on an infinite tree of life with a million branches we know nothing about. Tree of Life. The stuff of world's theology, I suppose. Yggdrasil, the Norse tree of life. The Etz Ha-Hayim of the Kabbalistic Jews, the Chinese, the Assyrians, the Egyptians all had a tree of life symbol. The Baha'is speak of it. And Christians lift up the tree of life with healing leaves in the book of Revelation. Well, I too use tree of life as a theological symbol, the one used by Charles Darwin to describe evolution. He used that phrase all the time. And this morning, after a wild week of loud pundits bringing their theology into just about everything, contraception, same-sex marriage, economics, I think it might be time for me to lay out my own theology before you all. if only to keep the strangeness of the present public theological discourse from just doing me in. So this morning, let me put it this way. I'm here to talk about love. I'm here to talk about profound theological connections that I personally make between evolution's tree of life and the reality of love. I'm here to talk about what I think about several times each day. And I do this. As I'm doing what I'm doing, I think about these things. As I'm writing sermons or calling folks on the phone or visiting people in duress, mourning alongside those who mourn, answering emails, writing letters, mentoring young ministers, doing my laundry, washing the dishes, and taking my daily fistful of pills and vitamins for my heart and my diabetic issues. Namely, I think about love every single day, 5 or 6 times, various aspects of love. I think about life and death every day, including my own death. I think about the that-ness that everything is and that I, by comparison, am no more important than a single grain of sand on an infinite beach. I have been thinking this way all of my life. It is not a new discovery. There was never a time when evolution was not my worldview. I was not raised to think, like many other people were apparently, I was not raised to think that science and faith were eternally at odds, and that if evolution was true, then God was meaningless. I was taught about evolution from first grade on in a Catholic school. Teachers held up ideas like the Big Bang billions of years ago, partially because the idea was, in fact, first articulated by a Belgian priest and cosmologist. Pierre Terrat de Chardin, a Jesuit priest, was required reading at my school, and I read all of his books. He wrote extensively about his theological understanding of evolution. I was taught in a Catholic high school that both creation stories in the book of Genesis were, in fact, witty, sarcastic commentaries about the creation stories of the neighboring Sumerians and Canaanites, and that only uneducated people actually thought there was an actual wooden tree of life in a garden someplace. Unlike many raised in different parishes or different denominations or different religions, I did not have a crisis of faith when I started going to that Universalist church in Farmington, Michigan back in 1972. I simply traveled further down the path shown to me as a child. I know now that I must have been lucky, since so many I have talked to in the last 35 years of my ministry are convinced that to move with the idea of evolution and not against it is to be irreligious, anti-Christian, and to toss God out the window. Evangelist David Stewart, for example, says that if I accept evolution as a fact, I am possessed by the devil. And according to Joyce Meyer, the popular television evangelist, she believes that people like me who have fallen for evolution are just plain, and this is her word, stupid. And she preaches, I have to say, with great charm, and to millions and millions of people every single day, 7 days a week. Me on a good Sunday, I preach to about 400 over the two services. Now, it is true, you don't have to remind me, that Richard Dawkins, the articulate atheist, insists that people who deny evolution are not just stupid, but insane. So the self-assured name-calling and virulent derision can be found right across the board. I, for one, am not really sure what such tactics can possibly accomplish. except a little bit of self-aggrandizement. If the often repeated polls of all kinds convince you, as they do me, more than 50% of all the United States Americans believe with Joyce Meyer and David Stewart and most other evangelists that I know, that I'm completely wrong about my theology. They say I'm not just wrong, but a real threat to their religious way of life. Over and over, they have preached to me that evolution is just my atheist belief and that it's my poor substitute for religion, real religion. The real religion, of course, is found only in taking the book of Genesis as a science text. And so it goes further for many. Even though Genesis in no way, and this is plain as the nose on my face, talks about prescriptions for contraception, passages from that misunderstood collection of Bedouin legends are being used to club our president on the head for his take on contraception. And of course, the famous and entirely distorted understanding, and it's distorted for liberals as well as conservatives, by the way, entirely distorted story of Sodom is being hurled around by those who have banned teachers from using the word gay in Tennessee schools so that the kids there never have to hear about Harvey Milk, as well as by those who want to get the judges of the Ninth Court of Appeals tossed off their benches and the governor of Washington State tossed out of her gubernatorial office for thinking that same-gender folks might be able to marry. Years ago, I made a firm decision for myself to never allow anyone on television or right in front of me to tell me that I'm irreligious if I don't accept their understanding of religion, their understanding, as if they get to define things for me. I don't let anyone else define my life for me, my theology for me, my secularity for me, my commitments or my love. I and I alone have that privilege, burden, and holy responsibility. I'm very clear about that, and I hope you're clear about that in your lives too. This afternoon, we are sponsoring an interfaith ceremony, as you heard, where people who have been together in committed relationships, either legally or without the blessing of the state, can be treated equally as they renew their vows of love and commitment. The state of Ohio may not like it that we think these are relationships of equal spiritual dignity, but then the state of Ohio, like any other state or country in the world, has only been involved in marriage for far less than 200 years. Before that, marriage was blessed by a justice of the peace or clergy, but even that tradition only began in the 1300s. That's 1300 years after Jesus. Before that, it was through clan and family arrangements only. No state-ordered certificates, no special privileges for anyone. When King Louis left his riches to Eleanor of Aquitaine in the late 1100s, he had to draw papers to give her that inheritance, no different from Leonardo da Vinci when he left his estate to his partner, Francesco Melzi. No one had wedding licenses in those days. Marriage by state law with documents kept in state offices, I'm telling you, is a relatively recent invention in history. Marriage, you see, is mostly, and I mean mostly, not about paper certificates. It's about love. Let me say a little bit more. I accept love as the ground of partnerships because the great insights of evolution, which founds my theology, reminds me that I am an animal, a mammal among mammals, and that evolutionary scientists have observed that many species, especially Homo sapiens, have, over the course of millions of years, come to feel more and more empathy. This empathy is in our biological makeup. The practices we call love evolved in human beings from that original empathy, especially rooted in the bonding of mother for child. And love, as Phyllis Rose defines it so well in your orders of service, is the momentary or prolonged refusal to think of another person in terms of power. I love that definition. It's so unusual and yet so accurate. Stephen Levine boldly adds, it's the only rational act in our lifetimes. Because love is not a feeling, that is, a reaction to stimuli, but a decision, usually based on a feeling. Yes, the feeling we call falling in love. It's a very human thing to do. But the feeling of being in love at the initial intensity does not seem to last for a very long time. But love itself can last for a very long time and deepen enough to survive great difficulties. If my son Tony does something that drives me absolutely up the wall, my love for him is not diminished one whit, and it never has. Oh yeah, I know that love can end. I've been in love 5 times. I've been brokenhearted 5 times in my life. But my capacity to love never seems to diminish. Remember, I didn't grow up with this absolute conflict between religion and science. Evolution can make perfectly good sense to those who use God language as much as to those who don't. The present Pope, with whom I share little theological language, certainly uses God language, I think he'll agree, to express his spirituality, yet he clearly accepts evolution as the best description of the way things are. The natural world, Dorian Lowe reminds us in her poem, The Life of Trees, is, however, not conscious in any way that would make sense to us, the thinking mammals, many of whom, like me, count themselves religious. The trees do not pray, she says, and though the stars return, they do not offer thanks, only ooze their sticky sap from their roundish concentric wounds. They straighten their spines and breathe again. The trees breathe, but not very much like we do. And they do not give thanks, and they do not love. And the stars that explode out in the vast universe and destroy the planets around them do not feel empathy for those planets. The abyss of space has no feelings, and it has no love. That possibility evolved, mostly in the human brain. Now, I know that sex and love are not the same thing. Same-sex copulation and different-sex copulation occur throughout all of nature in tens of thousands of species. But only humans, as far as we know, try to fuse these two great inheritances from evolution's vast centuries, sex and love, and overlap them. The fact that the universe is not tender, not devoted to me, does not make me resist my own tenderness, or worse, make me dismiss it as mere biology. Biology is not now nor ever has been mere. It's awesome and glorious and wondrous. The book of Job, with its amazing poetry, reminds us that awe and wonder about creation are the basic foundations for any theology worth a damn. Where were you when the foundations of the earth were being set down? You know so much. Tell me what you know. What influences contributed to the earth's size? Do you think there were blueprints, maybe? Measuring tools? Do you have the original plumb line? Did you personally help pour the stone? The book of Job is rather agnostic. It's not in any way a lecture about being faithful to God no matter how many children die horrible deaths in this world. No, the book of Job insists that we simply don't have all the answers to everything. We don't know, agnosticos, and we never will. The universe is far too vast and we are far too small. It reminds us, however, that love is central, the most rational thing that we do. Even though floods will wash children away, famine will kill us, and certain groups of people hurt and harass other groups of people for so-called biblical means. This is the point Malick was making in his film by quoting at the beginning of his film those words of Job that you heard earlier, and portraying the story of a family suffering the awful loss of a child in the context of the whole panorama of evolution, where whole species die out with regularity, and so many other awful things happen. Stop thinking the universe is about you and your concerns, my evolutionary theology tells me, quite religiously. The suffering you feel is not a punishment. It's not something you've earned. It's just part of the whole astonishing parade of evolution. You, however, you very small part of that evolution, have the power to love, the power to treat others not from a place of privileged power, but with recognition and empathy, with love. That love evolved in you. And maybe love is God, as Gandhi once said. Maybe that, in the end, those three words, are the best summary of my evolutionary theology. At least it grounds my life as I move through a theologically distorted modern world.